are at the Salk Institute in the office of Fred Gage, more commonly known as Rusty Gage, who's professor in the Laboratory of Genetics, but also the Vian John Adler Chair for Research on Age-Related Neurodegenerative Diseases. And that's something I want to get back to, because I want to bring together this whole notion of stem cells and aging and so on and so forth. He's also, I should say, by way of explanation, one of the founding board members of the Science Network. So thank you. So could you bring together for me where this research is going at this point in your lab?
Well, I would say that the best way to describe my interests are in the concept of neurogenesis, how neurons are born, what are the molecular mechanisms that are involved in their fate choice, their early decisions to become a neuron, and then subsequently how they elaborate into very specific types of neurons, like neurons of the hippocampus or neurons of the substantia nigra, dopamine neurons, or how do they distinguish between these? How are those decisions made? So that's the core of my interest, which has gotten me into issues related to stem cells, because that's the progenitor of these neural cells. Is the earlier you go, the more likely you are to find fundamental mechanisms that are involved in choice of fate. So I work in adult neural stem cells, or neural stem cells in general. And I continue to be interested in working on the area of what we call adult neurogenesis, or studying these primitive cells that exist in the hippocampus that continue to divide and give rise to neurons. So I can isolate those cells from the adult brain, put them in tissue culture dish, and study them at a cellular molecular level, or I can look inside the organism in living animals and do electrophysiological recordings from them, or ablate them and see what the consequences are. So that's one area of research in my laboratory. The way that relates to aging is that there's a dramatic decline in this process of adult neurogenesis with age in all species that we've looked at so far. So it starts off very high in young folks and then declines with age.
Right.
So that's sort of the aging component. And we're continue to examine this hypothesis that the decline of neurogenesis is somehow associated with loss of the ability to form new memories. And what is the relationship between those two? So that's a link.
Okay. Well, let's in fact go back to this notion of neurogenesis itself.
Okay.
The received wisdom at one point, not so very long ago,
right,
was you have got X neurons and you lose them and they decline. The whole notion of adult neurogenesis, in other words, the formation of new nerve cells, new neurons from stem cells and so on. You were very much implicated in that work. I mean, could you rehearse some of that for me?
Yeah.
Because it was a surprise, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much so. It goes in waves. The research went in waves. There were early discoveries or observations by, among others, were Joe Altman. And he showed that using a radioactively labeled molecule, thymidine, you can incorporate into a cell that's undergoing cell division. And he was really mapping out early development in the rat.
This is the 60s.
This is 60s, and looking at birth dating cells during early development.
Right.
And was surprised to see in several areas of the brain, cerebellum for one and hippocampus for another, that there were still dividing cells at birth. And so he pushed it out further and looked postnatally and reported in several papers that there were thymidine-labeled cells that were labeled after the animal was born. So this is a postnatal neurogenesis. They were published in very prominent journals. And I think it was somewhat controversial, and partly methodologically, it's where some of the complaints. Whenever there's something that's very new and very exciting, it requires more evidence to support its validity. And he was using this one technique. And what happens is the radioactivity comes off from the cell that's incorporating the thymidine, and the tissue is covered with an emulsion. So you're looking at these little speckles over the top of the cell. And there was a discussion about whether or not the speckles were over this cell or were they over another cell. And that made a difference because you would want to know whether or not they're over a neuron or are they over a glial cell. And you couldn't do double labeling at those times. You couldn't do a neural marker and...
So it was a technology?
Technology was limited, even though it was pretty convincing. I mean, I think when you look back on it now with hindsight, it looked pretty good.
Yeah.
And it was published in Nature or Science, and I think at the time it was really quite exciting. It did not catch on. There weren't a lot of follow-ups. I think it was methodologically challenging. He went off into other areas. He sort of left the area. Others in the field would... do similar kinds of studies, but still, he was just a sprinkling of activity in the field, mainly methodological problems.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the 80s, in the early 80s, Fernando Nottebohm presented
bird brains,
but using the same methodology.
Yeah.
And that was somewhat controversial as well, and it was harder to generalize or think about an experimental paradigm. But eventually that cleaned up, and I think one was left with the feeling that that was happening. You didn't know much about what the function was, but you knew that you were feeling more comfortable as it was some sort of neurogenesis. But I think most people felt it was epiphenomenal. It was so small amount, it couldn't be that important. And I should say at this point, there was no concept of stem cells. It could have been a neuron that was dividing.
Right.
And so the concept of stem cells wasn't there. And it was in the early 90s when a variety of labs began, including my own, isolated cells in a dish from the brain, dissected the cells out, and found out that they could be propagated in vitro. That led from these areas where there was going on, led you to believe, wow, these must be primitive cells that are in there because they retain this capacity for self-renewal for long periods of time in a culture dish. I'll take you a little bit through our own. We found this fairly serendipitously. We were working on engineering autologous cells like skin fibroblasts to express trophic factors like nerve growth factor, fibroblast growth factor, and we're transplanting them into various parts of the brain to see if we could induce regenerative responses. The cells would be a source of trophic factor and see whether or not we would get oriented growth, elongation, and so we were using gene transfer to the central nervous system actually for the first time as a way of probing this phenomenon of neurotrophins, which was a very exciting field in the 80s in the early 90s. Lots of activity was going on in there, and that's really what we're doing.
Yeah.
FGF had just been cloned. We got the cdna, we put it into fibroblasts.
Let me take you back for a second there for a general,
okay,
general audience. FGF, cdna.
So we took we obtained the dna sequence for a new trophic factor called fibroblast growth factor, and it had been shown here at the Salk by Roger Guillemin and some of his colleagues, that this molecule might have some activity at inducing axons to grow. And so here is a potential molecule for axonal growth. There's Adrian Burr, Patricia Wallachy. It was a very interesting experiment. So we, being here, were able to obtain the DNA, and we inserted the DNA into a cell with a very, very strong driver, so we could make lots of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to make sure that the molecule was being secreted so we could test whether or not it would have an effect. Bear with me, this is how we actually discovered this. So we put hippocampal, immature hippocampal cells in a dish.
Right.
And we put our cells, secreting fibroblast growth factor,
right,
in the same dish to see whether or not we could induce axonal growth, because that was basically the assay that they had used, but they used a recombinant or a protein form of it. We're using a genetically engineered cell to make it, and we wanted to make sure it was really making the accurate active form.
Right.
We put it in there, and all of a sudden cells didn't send out axons. They started dividing in culture rapidly and with no axonal outgrowth. And we thought we'd discovered a new factor, that somehow the FGF had changed our cells to secrete some new proliferation factor. So obviously we got the did a dose response curve on FGF2 and found that above a certain concentration, FGF switched its activity from being an axon growing mechanism to proliferation, so above a certain concentration. So that's how we actually discovered that FGF2 was a proliferation factor for neural progenitor cells. Was a mistake. Or not a mistake, but just sort of a serendipitous observation.
So
then, from then on, we could use FGF2 in a serum-free, without anything else in there, and get stem cells or progenitor cells. We didn't really know what to call them in those days.
Right.
Proliferating indefinitely. We could passage them, freeze them down. We were off and running at that point.
So again, for general audience, why is the hippocampus so important in this and dentate gyrus? I mean, why are these the breeding?
It is interesting. It is interesting. I think there's a couple answers to that question. One is that the hippocampus as a structure is anatomically very well defined. Anybody that looks at it, any lay person that looks at it with a simple stain, can see that it has very distinct layers to it.
And where is it?
It's in the temporal lobes of your brain, right in here. Inside, there's the cortex is overlying.
Right.
And then underneath, in the ventricles, is this seahorse-shaped structure, banana-shaped structure that sits in the temporal lobes.
That's called hippocampal.
It's hippocampus, yeah. and we know from other sets of experiments that in humans, the famous case of HM, that the hippocampus is involved in the acquisition of, is involved, this is from the 50s on, showing that hippocampus is involved in the acquisition of memories. And that dynamic statement right there of the ongoing process of making memories is very suggestive of a structure that has plasticity to it, that has, and
right,
where are memories, how are memories formed, how are they stored, all these kinds of questions revolve to a large extent around the hippocampus from the 50s on. And with that came this concept of plasticity. Another piece of information is that in the 70s, a guy named Tim Bliss discovered LTP, which is a electrophysiological manifestation of plasticity that has just been a tremendous tool for physiologists and anatomists to study the hippocampus, again, happening in the hippocampus. Turns out that a lot of these events occur in other structures as well, and you can have some kinds of memory and learning occurring in other structures. But the a variety of reasons the hippocampus has turned out to be useful. And as for the tissue culture, the cells grow well. You can dissect them and they grow well in tissue from postnatal brain. And the slice preparation, which is taking a brain, slicing a piece of it, putting it in a dish and recording from it, live tissue with its structure, is easily done in the hippocampus because you can look down and see where you are immediately. It's not just sort of a morass. It doesn't take a lot to do it. So physiologists, biochemists flock to the structure because they don't have to learn too much about neuroanatomy before they're already on top of the structure.
Right. So this whole notion of plasticity,
yes,
and memory, let me ask you about this. So HM, Henry Mollison, famous brain, analyzed by Brenda Milner and all sorts of people. One of the questions that people always ask me is, if plasticity exists, and when you recall a memory, you somehow change it. How can you ever have an autobiographical sense of solidity? Because you're always changing who you think you were, and what you thought you were, and where you thought you were.
Well, so this concept of reconsolidation that you're describing originally, it's not that old. I mean, it's a new way of thinking about it. Some wonderful experiments by Schechter, I believe, at Harvard. This is sort of human behavioral memory research. And really wonderful examples of how you can manipulate memories that you think you have based on re-exposure. The way we neurobiologists think about this is that the sensory information that we have during an experience is coming into the cortical areas. Our vision, our auditory, our olfactory information is coming to the cortex. That information, as it's being processed, subsequently goes to the temporal lobe, where it goes to an area called the entorhinal cortex.
Right.
The entorhinal cortex integrates, does some integration of that information at that point, putting it in some way we don't really understand, but there's some level of integration that occurs at that point. Then the information goes shuttling through the hippocampus. The first relay station are these dentate granule cells, which are the first cells to receive the input from the cortex.
Right.
They go to the CA3, and it's thought that that first relay station is really a initial discriminator of whether or not the information is new or not. It's novelty discrimination in some sense. Then if it's thought of as and seemed of as new, then it goes to the CA3 where there's some reconsolidation that occurs, some reinforcement of that memory in some way, passing on to the CA1 where additional processing of that occurs, some consolidation.
CA3 and CA1 are areas of the
hippocampus, and it's going through this, what we call the trisynaptic circuit, where it's going to dentate, CA3, CA1, and then it goes back out into the entorhinal cortex, a bit more processing, and then it's stored in some magical way in the cortex, of which we really don't understand.
Right.
When you have a memory, again, let's say some priming event that causes you to recall an event that happened in the past, one view is that you draw up that memory from its distributed location and you examine that in the context of whether or not what you're thinking of now is new or is it related to that memory that you had in the past. So another discrimination is made. But as that memory comes in, it's layered with what's happening now while you're doing the memory. So when it passes through the circuit again and is distributed, it carries with it the sort of new information. So it's not as if the previous memory is lost. It's just layered with a different texture based on what it is that you're experiencing while you're having that memory. And of course, memories are range in saliency depending upon how emotionally impactful they were, all that sort of thing. So it's not a memory, it's not a single thing. You can think of it as a continuum, and some memories are very rich visually, have no auditory association with them at all. Others are very much differently. But as I've described, it is sort of a view, and it incorporates the reconsolidation area, and that's how memories are modulated over time as we grow.
I've asked a lot of people that question. That's the clearest answer I've ever got. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So, but let me take you back to the story you were telling about neurogenesis, its beginnings. I'm looking at Gert Kepperman's book here on adult neurogenesis with some story in here. He was a former...
He was a postdoc in my lab.
Part
of the story is involves Gert.
Right. So, isn't there an interesting story here in the way science is done? Here's Joe Altman coming up with something in 62. People say, don't believe it, can't really feel like it's replicable.
I really don't think that's the way to look at it. I really think that the way to look at it
but
is
for 40 years.
Yeah, I think the way to think about it is that people put forward ideas, and science really is set up to prove ideas wrong. That's what we're. Yeah. That's what our goal is to prove an idea wrong. And you keep trying to find ways to prove your idea wrong.
So you're until a you're left with a Popperian. I mean,
yeah, in you're the sense left with
falsifying the.
Yeah, you're left with. That's the last man standing. So that's got to be as close to what truth as we have until somebody gets another method that's allowed to dig deeper into that. And so, you know, our truths are those things that haven't been falsified yet.
Yeah. And so,
but that doesn't mean you don't have great ideas, and people can have wonderful ideas. And so Joe's idea, or what he was promoting, was that there were cells dividing in the brain of an adult, and postnatally, really, more than anything else. And it's really, it was up to everybody else, and it was up to him to explain how this could happen in some other way, or some other way could explain it. And there were not enough techniques available at the time to really probe it enough. So you're left with, okay, I believe the thymidine is labeling there, but I'm not sure what that means. Yeah. And how do you get it function? How do you know those neurons are really useful? And there were no tools. And that's what I was going to tell you a little bit about, was once we had these cells dividing in dish with FGF2, we immediately said, this would be one way to test this in vivo hypothesis. And that is to put FGF in the brain to see if we could make more cells dividing, if we can activate the endogenous cells.
Okay.
So we used our, first of all, we used our engineered cells to secrete the protein, but then we ultimately, Gert and another postdoc in the lab, Geir Kuhn, who were really good fellows, looked at the literature with thymidine and they said, you know, this is really going to be very hard to quantify. I don't know how we're going to convince anybody. So together with a few other postdocs in the lab, they began to develop techniques that would be ways to confirm that these really were new neurons. So one of the first things we did was to take an antibody that was unique to neurons. A guy named Mullins had made this antibody called Nuin for some other purposes. And we used it in our culture dish to find cells, but also in vivo. And so we could say, okay, now we know those are neurons if they have this antibody staining. It's a nuclear antibody, isolated the nuclei, and characterized the nature of the protein. The second thing was to use bromideoxyuridine, BRDU, which, unlike thymidine, it's a label, but it's a uridine is labeled instead of thymidine. And instead of being radioactively labeled, it has an epitope on the uridine that an antibody recognizes. So when the BRDU is incorporated into the DNA, when the cell is under cell division, you can determine if that cell had incorporated by BRDU by using an antibody to stain it. And therefore, you eliminated all this artifact of the radioactive particles going and having to count particles, and that was localized just to the nucleus.
So I note, in fact, on Science Watch, they asked you, how did you, in fact, convince yourself that neurogenesis was going on in adult brains,
yeah,
that Kate showed me? This is the BRDU story.
This is the BRDU story. And there were two other things. One was to have BRDU labeling the nucleus. Then we double-labeled with Nuin, so we knew that they had become neurons. They weren't glia, they were neurons. We could stain for glia and neurons, so they were BRDU, neurons.
Which Joe didn't.
No, he didn't, couldn't do it, wasn't able to do it. It wasn't his fault, the technology wasn't there.
Right.
And the third thing that really helped us was confocal microscopy had just been introduced. And I was a beta station for a brand new confocal microscope, so we could optically dissect through our sections and stack our images so we could prove that the BRDU labeling was inside the nucleus of the cell. And the reason why this was important was because when we looked at it very carefully, we found many instances where BRDU was sitting on the outside, and those were likely glial cells.
Right.
But and they were labeled, they weren't labeled. We had no antibody to even know what they were. But if you looked at it in a scope straight down, it would look like it was in the nucleus. So the only way you could do it is cut optically with the microscope that gives you this digital image, and then stack all your images, and you could take and rotate in the computer, and you could see that it was inside. And that sealed the deal, I think, for most people. And we sent out these protocols for people to use.
Right,
and
right.
They started, that became the standard for how you would actually prove that you had neurogenesis or not. And then the final piece that really helped a lot of this was, again, a confluence of technology. There's a mathematical methodology called stereology, which is a quantitative way of counting the total number of events or objects or cells in a field, and doing it in a way that took into consideration the shrinkage of the tissue, the volume, the area, all these, so you come up with a really strong number. And so we applied that technology to this confocal microscopy, double labeling with two antibodies and BRDU, and that's how we became absolutely convinced that there was neurogenesis occurring in the hippocampus, at least.
And that became a defining moment, actually.
According
to the literature, anyway.
Yeah, we did. A lot of my lab at that point felt convinced enough that it was worth putting time into, and that's.
Yeah. But if you know the irony, I mean, if you'd been Joe Altman in 1962, '63, '64, you'd have been.
No, but lost. I don't think so. I think it's
because you wouldn't have the technology.
Oh yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. You had to have the. You had to be at the right place at the right time when the technology from other fields was feeding in.
Yeah,
and that's absolutely the case.
Build me a story now from, you were just elected as president of the International Society for Stem Cell Research, ISSCA.
Mm-hmm.
Build me a story between this kind of work and stem cells, if you wouldn't mind. Because the stem cells now have become such drivers in this, thinking.
I think in the early days of stem cells, for the most part, we talked about tissue-specific stem cells.
Right.
So there were people that were working in hemopoiesis, like Irv Weissman, John Dick, and others.
Right.
Our work, where we defined these cells in vivo, in the hippocampus as being stem cells, by virtue of the fact that we could take them out of culture, put a single cell in a dish, and it would expand up, and those cells could differentiate into all three lineages.
Right.
That allowed us to at least talk about these as stem cells. There were debates about whether or not you would call it really a stem cell or a neural progenitor cell.
Right.
Those kinds of things remain today. But at least within the debate of stem cells, people were looking for stem cells in the skin. Lainey Fuchs was doing this. Where was the niche, the hub area where they were coming from? So most organs, people in different organs that were interested in development and processing, were searching for a stem cell that was existing in the adult. And that was where a lot of the stem cell field began.
Mm-hmm.
And when we would have the early meetings in Keystone 15 years ago, 16 years ago, stem cells meetings were primarily about adult stem cell or tissue-specific stem cells. There were issues about cells floating around in the blood that were mesenchymal, that were pluripotent, that could give rise to everything. And there were amazing studies where they were injecting them into blastocysts and getting whole animals coming from a cell. And in those early days, we were a little more open to other kinds of stem cell concepts. We would invite people that worked in Hydra. We'd invite people from plant biology, because they have stem cells there too. So these early days, it was really trying to figure out what it is that was a stem cell. Then there were some revolutionary moments occurred when stem cells, like human and primate embryonic stem cells, could be generated in a dish. Jamie Thompson was early on in the primate work. And of course, mouse ESLs were there all the time, making transgenics. You had that. But I don't know if it's fair to say, but the mouse work was really thinking of it more as a whole organ, you know, to make mouse animals. And I remember having this conversation many times with David Anderson about the people that work on stem cells in a dish and study the mechanisms of fate choice at a molecular level, and then looking at in vivo in a living organism to see how they differentiate. And there were two separate camps that didn't really overlap, and the people that were working in vivo weren't really thinking in terms of stem cells. That wasn't the way they thought about it.
But this is also recent, isn't it? I mean, we just had the sixth stem cell meeting on the Mesa. One keynote was Ian Wilmot, who also was at the first Science Network launch event just before Prop 71. Cloning Dolly the sheep, 1996. I mean, nothing. I mean, it's extraordinarily recent, all of this sort of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, in some sense, it's moving very quickly, very, very quickly. I mean, you figure that iPS cells or induced pluripotent cells are five or 6 years old now, 5 years.
Yeah,
no, it's happening at a very fast pace. I think it started pretty slow, and there were some key events that attracted some good people.
Here's a paper that you co-authored with somebody in your lab, Kristin Brennand, who of course spoke at one of the stem cell meetings. This is a very recent paper. Concise review of the promise of human-induced pluripotent stem cell-based studies of schizophrenia, for example. The use of these things in specific afflictions. I mean, do you see that as a burgeoning field? I mean,
well, I should say that it started some years ago with somatic cell nuclear transfer. That's when you transfer the nucleus of a mature cell into a the nucleus of an immature cell into a mature cell and reprogram that cell. And this is what Ian did with Dolly, right?
Right.
So the idea was that what if you took diseased DNA from a diseased person, took the nucleus out and put it into a somatic cell or vice versa? Could you model the disease and then could you turn those cells into a very specific cell type so you could study the disease?
Which kind of led to what Shinya did. Sort of.
So what Ian did and what was surrounding all of what Ian's work was the knowledge that there was something unique that existed in the cytoplasm of a very immature cell. There were proteins or something in there that could reprogram or redirect the DNA sequence, not the actual DNA itself, but the activity of the DNA, and change it into a more immature state. And this was called reprogramming through somatic cell nuclear transfer.
Right.
And many labs were looking to find out what the molecules were that could do this.
Right.
And it really, all this goes back to work by John Gurdon.
Right.
50 years ago.
Yeah.
And when he did this with Xenopus, showing that in fact it could be reprogrammed. Right. It took a very long time until it came to Ian, where he actually demonstrated in a very dramatic way.
Right.
And then, so I'm just telling you that around that time was where the modeling of human disease came in. I remember talking to Ian and others about what would be the first disease that you would want to think about, or most straightforward, how are you going to model a human disease in a dish?
Right.
And getting donor eggs became an ethical issue and a problematic and paying for them. All of a sudden, this paper comes out in Cell saying that you could introduce four genes into a somatic cell like a skin cell and reprogram that cell, that those genes would cause the DNA to function much more like an embryonic stem cell. It would just convert it into an embryonic stem cell. And those cells could propagate indefinitely as embryonic stem cells. That's what Yamanaka then called induced pluripotency. It was induced because he had to put factors in there.
Right.
Then this whole idea of modeling disease became an immediate reality because all you had to do is get a skin biopsy from any patient, anybody, you, and reprogram your cells in a dish and start looking at your brain cells and your heart cells because programs and methods were being developed for differentiating these cells from embryonic stem cells into whatever cell type you wanted. But then, and that caught that is catching on. I mean, we're still in the middle of that revolution right now. The caution, of course, is how could you ever really recapitulate a disease process in a dish by isolated cells? This was the negative statement. And if there weren't as many people working on this, and if the tools weren't available, it could have just died. If you didn't develop tools for differentiating the cells into certain types, if we couldn't record electrophysiologically or do calcium imaging, or, you know, you could imagine how this wouldn't have passed. But one of the good things about it was tremendously reproducible. High school students do this. This review is based on a paper that Kristen wrote in Nature on this modeling of schizophrenia, and this just reviews this and other issues. Some of the cells that were programmed by high school students during the summer. So this is not, and right now, reprogramming is becoming, you don't do it, in a very short time, nobody will do this anymore in their own lab. You'll just send the fibroblast to a center, a core, and 2 months later, they'll send you all the clones. And then you get down to the hard work of trying to see whether or not you can find differences between your patients and things. So the actual making of this now is like a commercial enterprise.
That launch meeting that we did for the Science Network was called Science Ethics.
Mm-hmm. 6 years ago.
At the crossroads.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are the ethical issues at this point?
That's really, well,
things changed.
Things have changed a lot. We still need to work with human embryonic stem cells. These are the in vitro fertilized cells, mm-hmm, that are authentically made from sperm and egg that then forms a blastocyst in a dish from which you can take the inner cell mass, put them in a dish, and they'll grow as embryonic stem cells. Mm-hmm. That's how, mm-hmm, embryonic stem cells, naturally occurring embryonic stem cells, are formed.
Right.
Induced pluripotency cells are made from anybody's peripheral tissues.
Right.
And they are reprogrammed into a cell that looks very much like that. But the debate now is how similar are they? How similar can they actually be?
Right. Right.
And we need these authentic ones to make the comparison. So there is the continued ethical debate about putting egg and sperm together and making,
right,
a blastocyst.
Right.
So it's not really an ethical, I guess it's religious more than anything else. But anyway, it's there, but it's tamped down so much because most people are working on these iPS cells. But there still is a bit, you know.
As we did at the last meeting, there are obviously some constraints there, some problems. People worry about the epigenetics and so on and so forth.
But those aren't really ethical issues. I think the ethical issues really are things like, still, the things that will remain are things like chimeras. When you want to transplant a cell into a mouse, let's say you have a human diseased cell, Parkinson's disease, schizophrenia, something like that. Yeah. You can measure them really well in a dish. You can do all kinds of things. But what about if you wanted to look at them in an in vivo context, in a living animal? You can transplant those cells into, for example, the developing brain, and those cells will differentiate into human neurons in a brain context.
Right.
The challenge there is, the ethical issue there is, how many cells would you do before, I mean, it's not necessarily a concern I have because the survival is not that good. But you could say when it's a human, more of a human brain than a mouse brain, that sort of argument. And I'm not going to elaborate too much on it, but you can get what I mean by that.
Yeah,
yeah. So those are some of the ethical issues that remain. Chimerism, it's called. when to do that early in development, can you put human and other species together? And I think that is something that I think people need to keep a close eye on and have society help us evaluate what's right and what's wrong, what we should do. But the ethical issues are it's fine. Maybe people are being sensitized, or maybe I'm just living in such a small world that I don't see it. I see the other side. Here's another ethical issue that
But you're president of the society that deals with these things.
Well, and here are the ethical issues that I'm concerned with. The promise of stem cells has been hyped so much that unethical people are using whatever type of cell and injecting it into people, telling them that they have a cure. So these are unestablished clinical, not trials, clinical paid studies that are being done, where people are being paying $50,000 to receive some artificial cell, or we don't even know what it is.
In this country as well as...
It happens in this country, it happens in other countries, and that is the big, I believe, an enormous ethical decision, cultural decision that our society, I'm talking about ISSCR now, needs to be aware of. As to the scientists need to help public to monitor these things and help define what makes a reasonable clinical trial, what is the evidence that supports the fact that this clinical trial or this clinical study is justifiable, that you're justified in paying $50,000 for a possible cure. So this is to me one of the big challenges.
Yeah, you had a paper. I mean, George Staley also wrote a paper on this issue, right?
Absolutely. Our society continues to do this, and we have a website called A Closer Look. It's a website linked to our own website, which gives some of the parameters that you might consider if you're going into a clinical trial. What are the things that you should look for? We want to do more than that, and we're working on that now.
Go back to some earlier work. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of interest at one point about, I'll give you a clue and you can just take it from running mice.
Oh, yeah. So back to the adult neurogenesis story, one of the things that we felt would allow us to get a better handle on this would be the idea of neurogenesis, because there's still, this was in the 90s, and there was still a significant amount of skepticism and about not as much whether or not it occurred, but whether or not it had any significance at all.
Right.
And we figured that if we could manipulate it, manipulate the rate, and see some outcome by manipulating, block it, stop it from occurring, make more of it, and then monitor behavior. Since it's occurring in the hippocampus, we started thinking about this. And there were two different studies that we initiated. And one was by Gert when he was in the lab. And that was to take normal healthy mice that lived in an enclosed environment, and like normally in our cages, and take animals and put them into an enriched environment. And this study builds on work that had been done in the 70s by Rosenzweig, Bennett, and Diamond, where you put put animals in an enriched environment, and they have more synapses, more things happen.
Right.
And so we tried this to see what the impact would be on neurons, in these new neurons. And this is where the quantitation came in to play, where it was important. Because you could argue that the BRDU labeling could still have some artifact associated with it. Because if you're just counting those cells, not really sure, but we reasoned that if you could increase the total number of newly dividing cells, that the total volume of neurons in the hippocampus, the total number of neurons, would increase. So we challenged the animals in these enriched environments, changed the toys out every day so that they could see something new. And at the end of 45 days, we looked in the hippocampus of the animals, and we counted all of the granule cells using stereological methods that I told you about.
Right.
And a normal widely used strain of mice called C57 has about 300,000 granule cells on either hippocampus. But the animals that spent 45 days in the enrichment that were matched for sex, matched for age, matched for everything except for the different environments, and all postnatal enriched environment, not throughout life, but just in the postnatal period, they had 50,000 more neurons per side. This was not BRDU labeling. They had 50,000 more neurons.
That's a significant
force. It's a significant force, 15%. And we published that paper in Nature saying, for us, that was another watershed, because now it's not just, you know, it's a small number, but over time, this can have a fairly large impact. Yeah. And we showed that increase, the animals learned a task or remembered a task better. They remembered a task better by virtue of having this enriched experience. So now, then Henriette Van Prague, who was a postdoc in the lab at the time, along with Gerrit and Georg, said, well, let's look at the environment. What is it about the environment that causes this new neurons? And one thing that was clear is we put running wheels inside the chain, inside the open box.
Right.
So one question was, and they spent a lot of time in the running wheel. So could it be, how much of the induced neurogenesis was due to enriching experience, and how much was just physical exercise? So Henry did an experiment where she took and put the cage inside their little home cage, and then had the enriched environment without the running wheels and a bunch of other controls.
Right.
And that's when she discovered that just running in a running wheel increased the proliferation of cells dramatically. I mean, 3-4-fold over what they would experience without the running wheel. But interestingly, the enriched environment had a separate effect. There was no increase in proliferation, but instead of where neurons normally die quite a bit after they're being born, so about 60 or 70% of them die in these small and enclosed chambers, if you put them in an enriched environment, essentially all of them survive. So it had a survival effect by enrichment,
right,
whereas physical exercise was inducing the proliferation of more cells. But they would still die off in the enclosed environment. But their level was at the level of the enrichment because there were so many more being born. So what they did was to tease out the fact that in our physical environment and how we interact with our environment has one impact on the newly born cells, where our interaction, our cognitive interaction with the environment had a completely different effect.
So the message was exercise more, but do it in an enriched environment.
Yeah. A complex changing environment was the way we sort of think. Yeah.
Yeah. What a wonderful. So is that still solid?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, that's that. The nice part about it, both of those have been massively replicated. We actually use the running as the tool to boost neurogenesis all the time. It has a really strong cognitive enhancing effect, too. You get really good learning. It's still the best way to increase neurogenesis, to put the animals into a running wheel, and then it'll do it.
Do you exercise?
I do. I did before, though.
How did you actually get into this business in the first place, and actually go back some way, if you wouldn't mind? Don't say I arrived at the sulk in... Why science at all? I mean, a teacher, a parent?
It's probably... people ask me this question before. I think I trace it to my sister. She is a scientist, and she would always send me science books when I was in boarding school, and she would... I give her credit that she always... My parents didn't have a lot of science education. They were well-educated and successful people, but it was my sister that chose science, and she consistently presented science to me as an important alternative in my career choices.
Yeah. She's still in?
She is currently at the University of Washington in the engineering department, and she runs a program for... She's about ready to retire. She runs a program for that provides mentorship for women in engineering. So she's part of a large organization women in science. So she was president of this organization
for a while. Tremendously important.
Yeah, and she has a variety of centers where they provide mentorship, they do studies, ways in which to keep women in engineering, because the dropout rate is... Well, first of all, very few go in, and then the dropout rate drops because there's not mentorship. But it's changing. I think Even Washington, since she's been there, has gone up. I don't know what the figures are, but it's working around the world. I mean, they have all these colleagues in all these different countries, and they meet and talk about different ways to try to get women involved in science.
Never mind women, just people going through your lab. I mean, as I look on these papers, you know, Brad Imoni and Alison Moultrie, Jean Yeo, Carol Marchetti. I mean, a great collection of people that have come through your lab. What's your advice to a young scientist, to use the old Peter Medawar phrase? I mean, what have you done to help direct them? I mean,
well, I would think that part is to select people initially that have good potential, and it's always hard to figure that out. But that's made easier by working here at the Salk Institute, because this is a great place to work, and people know it. And we have a lot of great scientists here. So you're not just coming to work with me. You get to work here at the Salk and be around other great scientists. We have a lot to pick from. So we have the cadre of people that want to come here. You get to select the very best, or what you think is the very best.
Right.
Okay. So the part of the elements there, I look for people, obviously, that are very smart, but they're all really smart. I like to have people that have experience. They've already, I can at this point, and have always looked for people that have some track record of doing something successful in their life. It may not have been science all the time, but they'd shown evidence of being able to finish something, to start something and finish something. That's really very important. Not just to talk about things, but to actually get them done. And I do look for people that are enthusiastic, that are doing science because they just really like it. You know, and whenever I have discussions with students that are going through critical periods and trying to figure out what they're going to do, and should I publish it here or should I get this kind of fellowship, I try to redirect them into thinking about what do they really want to do. Because you're only going to do something really well if you're doing what you really want to do, where you go to bed at night and you think about it, and you wake up in the morning and that's what you're thinking about. If you have that passion to science, you'll be successful if you have the foundation of being smart and well-trained. It's passion. Very important.
Passion. Okay.
generalized.
All right. Current issue of Nature. Last minute wins for U.S. science. Francis Collins gets more budget money through blah, blah, blah. The connection between science and society and the importance thereof. When he came into office, President Obama said his administration would restore science to its rightful place.
Right.
What's the rightful place? He gave no coordinates. I mean, what do you think is the rightful place of science in the society?
My interpretation of that is that the administration was saying that they wanted to be an evidence-based society. We want to make decisions based on the evidence. And science is sort of the beacon of a discipline that makes decisions based on evidence. We don't make excuses for that. That's what we are. That's what we have to be. And science becomes the beacon for a country if you promote that concept of evidence-based, and you use the same scrutiny in your own political affairs, in your own climate affairs, in your own economic affairs, if you apply the basic tenets that science uses for their everyday activities. Now, it's hard to do everything based on evidence, but I think he's talking about, in my interpretation, is moving society more into that realm. And in so doing, highlight and support science to provide evidence-based solutions to societal problems, to issues. And these are not just healthcare, but science is broad, economics, other areas that are evidence-based as well, broadly based. I think the other part of it is, as we've talked about in stem cells, there are unpredictable things that emerge out of science using the scientific methodology. By using the scientific methodology, piling up facts, following a procedure, that's the end of the conversation. By doing that, you come up with...
We have some noise going on.
Yeah.
Don't worry. We're at the Salk Institute.
It'll
be fixed.
And so that's how you actually build up evidence towards the things that you want to solve. But out of that often occurs spin-offs, ideas that you never anticipated. And that's one of the real beauties of science and following along the path is looking out for discoveries that come out that you hadn't anticipated. I would say that's one of the things that Salk is really good at, and one that we really encourage our young people to be aware of. When you're doing an experiment, our young faculty, we want them to do something extraordinary.
A couple of questions I ask everybody. One of them is about the history and philosophy of science, and whether people have a sense of context when they come into a place like this, or whether they're just ground to the bench. And so I like to ask people who've been in the discipline for a year, if I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring to your table, dinner table, anybody from any period of history, any discipline, any time, who would you like to talk to?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many. There really are so many. I couldn't really even think of one. Of course, Darwin comes immediately to mind as somebody that you would... One important thing is asking to bring them to the table at a certain age, because I don't want somebody else to pick when I get to have them at the table. I don't want them at the very end of their life. I want them at a critical point in their life where they're trying to make a decision about, you know, what's happening. And I want to ask them, what are they thinking about? How are they going to make, what was in their mind when they were making these decisions about which way to go, which directions to go? Einstein would be wonderful to really know what he was thinking about when he was at the patent office. Because during that period of time, all these patents were flooding in there about time.
Right.
And, you know, the wars were imminent, and they were trying to find a common time.
Yeah.
So they get the troops coming and going. You know, how was he thinking about that relative to his own personal interests? So, it's not the discipline. I mean, just reflecting on this, not really so much the discipline as being able to get somebody who'd made a remarkable series of discoveries, and be able to talk to them at
about
a time
when, they were
when it was
beginning.
Like,
to.
Or maybe when they just solved it, or something around there.
Yeah. So Alan Lightman's novel, Einstein's Dream. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Or Darwin on the Beagle.
Absolutely.
To think. Whoa,
exactly. What's going on? Yeah. But you'd like to be there and hear them say it. The novels are good, and they probably represent likely what happened, but it would be so much fun to hear them say it.
It's a great idea. Gage.
Mm-hmm.
There are rumors around. There's even written evidence that you are related to Phineas Gage in some distant fashion.
Yeah. So
Mike obviously had
the tamping iron through
his head. And
so my grandfather was an amateur genealogist.
Yeah.
And when I was really quite young, still in college, he actually showed me this collection. I inherited it from him. And he obtained letters in the 50s from the Harvard Museum of Anatomy, talking about the cast of Phineas Gage and the tamping iron, which are in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to find out, my grandfather was trying to find out, if this was the Phineas Gage that is in our lineage, that was in the approximate right area at approximately at the right time.
Yeah.
And the best of that kind of circumstantial evidence suggests that there was a Phineas Gage in my lineage, great-great-granduncle something, and this Phineas Gage in the tamping iron. They were all in the right area, but, you know, there could have been So that's what it is.
But it would be nice if, in the sense that, of course, as you know, there was a paper that Hannah and Antonio Damasio did a long time ago, showing that exactly where the tamping iron would have gone through the head.
Absolutely.
And that this was one of the fundamental elements of understanding a science of personality, as it were. So,
I actually
kind of a neuroscience of personality.
Yes. So. When I was young and still teaching, I actually taught this as a way to introduce localization of function versus diffuse function. And neurology is a disease, and I have slides someplace where it's got the cast of Phineas with it, and I use this. I have all the original literature, what happened to him, all the papers in the 1850s, and there's actually a very interesting, I don't know if it still exists, but in Melbourne, University of Melbourne, they have a very, very strong guy named McMillan, I believe, who is... most knowledgeable about Phineas. And there's more data coming out about him all the time, that he wasn't nearly as impaired as people thought he was previously, new letters that were found. Yeah. Phineas and McMillan has a couple books. I met him, actually, the last time I was there. And early on, they had a drinking club in Melbourne called the Phineas Gage Club. And I'm an honorary member of this club.
Oh, very good.
Which has the, I think their motto is, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
All right. Last question.
Yeah.
What are you optimistic about?
Single cells. Single cell analysis. Somatic diversity. There is a new field, a new science that is emerging, that is considering the diversity that exists between two individual cells that are sitting next to each other. And that is something we haven't really considered in the past. We sort of think of groups of structures having functions. And I'm very interested and very committed to understanding another layer of diversity, another layer of somatic mosaicism is the term we're beginning to use, that underlies a greater amount of complexity that exists between individuals than we've thought of before. And this difference is reflected not just in electrical activity, but the DNA sequence between cells within the brain. So we used to think of you having one genome. Right, the DNA from every cell of your body is the same, and it's going to be different from somebody else, but your DNA is the same. Now we know that's not the case, and particularly in the brain. Individual neurons have different DNA mutations. There's lots of variability and mosaicism that's going on in the brain that we believe is generated during neurogenesis, and this adds a level of diversity to our brain. It doesn't change them from being a granule cell to a pyramidal cell, but it adds some variability on, say, how they would respond to potassium or chloride. And this added variability or added diversity within and between cells adds to the range of responses that any one individual may have to some novel experience that they may have in their life over time. And adds to the differences that exist between two individuals, but also expands your repertoire. You can think of it in terms of the immune system is the easiest way to do it. Right. When you have a diversity of responses in the.
So, but I've in fact argued in some things I've written that what we need is a science of individuality. Mm-hmm. But that was usually done at the cognitive psychological area. You're talking about something far more basic, and this is also seems to be, although I may be wrong about this, to be the antithesis of systems biology.
Not the antithesis. Well, I'm not, just to be argumentative, I would say it's another layer. It adds another layer into it. It's definitely systems, but you have to think of it in a much more complex way than sort of widget systems. This is, you have to incorporate into it the complexity of each of the widgets. So actually, there's a review of this coming out in Scientific American on this whole concept.
I'll look forward to it.
Based on a whole series of articles we haven't talked about at all. It's another part of work that I do, taking over my lab right now. That's what I'm excited about. This deals with these mobile elements, retrotransposable mobile elements, which is another story. Another time.
We'll do it another time. Rusty Gates, thanks so much.
Sure.